You're listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast, a product of the Oregon Basketball Coaches Association. To learn more, visit our website at or.nhsbca.org. Welcome to the Season 1 finale of the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. I'm Derek Dumon, OBCA Vice President and Boys Basketball Coach at West Albany High School. Today, I'm joined by Nick Robertson, retired boys basketball coach from Beaverton High School. Coach, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm doing really well, Derek. Yeah, I'm excited to be on your podcast and kind of looking back at my last week. I celebrated my 59th anniversary with my wife, Katie, and kind of looking back over all the years of coaching. You got to have a great coach's wife to be able to survive 41 years. I was 41 years as a head coach, so she hardly missed a game, so I feel pretty blessed, I'll tell you. Yeah. So doing
yeah,
well.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Well. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, thanks for taking the time to join us, and, you know, shout out to you and you and Katie for being together for so long. No doubt coaches' wives are the most underrated part of our profession.
Yeah, that's for sure.
For those that might not be familiar with you or maybe the young ones in the game that weren't around when you were coaching, can you kind of give us a little bit about your basketball coaching history, how you got into coaching, and how you ended up being where you are now?
Well, you know, I grew up in Eugene, one block from Mack Court, okay? And my dad worked in a store. He was a partner in a hardware sporting goods store with his partner to start with was Joe Gordon, a Hall of Fame baseball coach, and then John Warren, who became a basketball coach at Oregon. And so living there and being around athletics, the coaches from Oregon were in our home all the time. And so, you know, it kind of started that way. I went to what's called Marist High School now. It wasn't called that at that time, but that's where I started playing. Then, you know, living one block from Mack Court, we snuck in every weekend and played basketball. So it was kind of a nice setup. So my first job, getting out of college, my first job was at Sandy High School for 6 years. I was the head assistant coach for one and then took over for 5 years there. A great spot to start. And then I moved into the inner city. I think I'm going to go in here and give this a shot. I went to Franklin and spent 2 years there. And then I moved to McMinnville, where we were for 12 years. My family was really raised there. My daughter was grade 1 through 12, Annie was, and Rick and Greg were grades 3 and 4 through 12. So, and then in 1983, I think it was, I moved to Beaverton High School, where I was the basketball coach and athletic director. I was there 22 years. I was the AD 16 years, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, that's... that was my basketball journey as a high school basketball coach, so 41 years as a head coach and 42 years overall in education. So never had a bad day. Even I'd have to say that even after a one-point loss or some guy banked in a full quarter on you, I still really enjoyed every day, okay?
Absolutely. Coach, you've had the opportunity, you know, to coach and teach the game around the world, based on some of the things that you've done. Can you talk about some of those experiences and what you noticed about the game throughout the world?
Well, I would say, you know, I got some great opportunities. I mean, I got to coach the McDonald's game twice, once in New York area, and then in Oakland. So, you know, and then I coached a bunch of all-star games. And, you know, all those were different in the sense of trying to get kids' attention that were all world. That was really quite a challenge. You know, I coached at Colorado Springs in their Olympic development camp. I coached the Olympic Festival in North Carolina, which was about a 10-day stint, which was just like the Olympics in a sense, the whole thing, the walk-in. It was a great experience, and I was an assistant coach for the West team there. Barry Adams and I then did a 10-day basketball clinic or camp in Croatia, in an island off of, not the island, but the area called Istria. And what a great experience. The kids were great. They were so well versed in, of course, soccer and team handball, and these were really their main sports, and so we had to convince them about basketball. Great challenge. Now and then, you'd see a kid go down the court, and he'd fumble the ball, and he'd just keep it going with his foot, go down, and then kick it into a goal. We go, what the heck are you doing? You know. So, but the love of the game is the same everywhere, I think. No different than here. We just had a great time teaching these kids what to do, and then we enjoyed the international experience in Croatia. Matter of fact, I went back later with my wife and another couple and really toured that country. A great spot. You know, you could buy a beer that was a foot tall for 50 cents or something, you know, so the whole, it was just a fantastic experience. And basketball, you know, every day you were, you know, 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the afternoon, and you take a break at the pool, and quite a situation. So, but, you know, kids love the game all over, really do.
Yeah, what were some of the things maybe that you learned or brought back with you from those experiences, you know, those Olympic experiences or coaching that McDonald's All-Star game? Was there anything that you learned from those moments and opportunities that you brought back with you to coaching in Oregon?
Well, you know, when you're coaching talent like that, the McDonald's game and stuff, and, you know, your basic thought is, you know, that you know, you never have a double standard. Well, wow, it's really tough in this situation. When I coached at Colorado Springs, probably the best player on the four teams ended up being a trailblazer. He was from Michigan State. I won't throw his name out there, but, you know, they had a rule every night that no one was to leave the campus. This guy left the campus every night and was brought back by the police, and every day they warned him that would be his last chance, you know. So I learned, wow, huge double standard these people had, you know. So, you know, I also got a chance to coach with Rick Adelman with the Trailblazers. He let me be one of the assistants in the summer basketball, and we coached in Salt Lake City. And then, interesting, we had our big final game at Providence Park. We put a floor down on the baseball football field and played outside that year. And, you know, there's a lot of things you learned about coaching these great athletes, which the coach didn't have all the control you do in high school. I mean, the general manager comes in and says, hey, I want this guy to play the point all summer, or I want this. So, you know, what you learned was there's a lot of things behind the scenes when you're coaching those big-time guys.
What are maybe some of your top coaching concepts or beliefs that you tried to instill in your players every day at practice?
Well, you know, that's something that we had at Beaverton and McMinnville and all the way through all the schools. We talked about game speed. You've got to practice at game speed. The effort's got to be the same every day. Never, never have a bad practice. You know, and let me tell you this. I was very fortunate to have some great players that never allowed a bad practice. And probably one of the first ones was Charlie Sitton at McMinnville. He was 6'8", and he went harder than any 5'9 guard ever went. So, you know, if anybody had bad practice, he was going to, you know, put him against the wall. So, you know, that was my biggest thing was, you know, you can't expect to win if you don't practice hard every day. And so our basic mantra was expect to win. So if we couldn't say that, so when we went on the floor before a game, our thought and our chant was expect to win, because we felt we had worked harder than the other team. So we went that carried through everything we did during the day, offense or defense. You know, if you expect to win, you better give me the best effort you have. So that's really the concept that I had every day was game speed, effort, and never have a bad practice. Expect to win.
And how did you go about holding kids accountable to that? I think that that's just something hard to do as far as, like, hard work. I think we all preach that as coaches. But, like, what were some things that you did to hold those kids accountable to ensure that they were bought in and working hard every day in practice?
Excuse me. Well, Derek, the thing that we did was our seniors – were expected to never have a bad practice and never allow anybody else to have one. So it was tradition. It was seniority. for example, at Beaverton, one of my first years at Beaverton, we had a 6'7" post kid. And he was a decent player, good player. I'm not sure he ever scored in practice because the seniors would not allow it. They'd strip him. They'd rip the ball out of him. They'd check him. And that's the way our seniors played. So if your seniors play that hard and you sit down with them before the season and say, this is what it's all about. And so tradition carried us in most of my programs. The older guys, you know, now and then you'd get a great sophomore or something that could actually be a leader. I had a couple at Beaverton and, of course, one at McMinnville that was just super about leadership. You just don't allow any fall off. And that's really how we got it done.
How did you get that tradition started? So, you know, Sandy, your first head coaching job, you've just been the assistant. How did you kind of set that tone? Was it just that conversation, or were you having to do extra things in practice to get that started?
Well, I think, first of all, you can't have any double standards. You're going to hear me talk about that. But, you know, everybody plays the same standard. And whether he's your best player or he's your 12th man, everybody goes hard. That's an expectation. And you talk about it every day. You talk about mental toughness and how tough can you be? Can you miss 10 free throws in a row and make the final two? When I was at Sandy, I had a kid that became an All-American football player named John Sandstrom. He was All-American at Oregon State. He was a heck of a basketball player, but he had a heck of a temper. And, you know, but he was one of the world's great effort guys. He went 1,000 miles an hour. I just had to control his temper. But he was a great example for our other guys. He never, ever slowed down. That was my first job. So he was a challenge. You know, I'll never forget his mother calling me up saying, hey, he's got a temper. I go, really? You know, so, you know, but you have to have somebody set the tone. If you don't have somebody set the tone as a coach, it's pretty dang tough because you can't, you know, as you get older, you know, the worst thing you can do is try to play in practice. I've seen coaches try to do that. It just doesn't work out, you know. So your drills, your expectation in your drills, you don't run long drills that have no expectations. There's expectations in every drill, and that's what you know. And you're on them about it. I mean, you don't ever allow someone to not block off. You know, I mean, obviously their kids aren't perfect, and it happens. But your expectation is that he blocks off every time. So. You know, that's how you start things and run it through that way, just expectations, mental toughness, you know.
Now, your teams were known to be particularly tough and physical on the defensive end. I'm sure that's something that you taught was an expectation for you guys. Can you talk about your philosophy behind that and how you taught and instilled that in your players?
Well, again, it kind of started off with mental toughness, just the fact that you'll hear me talk about my camp later on. But we had a rule in our camp, third through 12th grade. There are no excuses. We have no excuses in our program. So no one was allowed to stand there and show you with his hands, that open his hands up and say, well, coach, I get, you know, whatever. There's no excuse. There's no excuse for being late. There's no excuse for not playing hard. So, you know, that, and so physically what we did was we ran the same drills. You know, if you're going to establish a defense, you establish it by keeping the man in front of you. You establish it by blocking off. You establish it by contesting every shot. Now, if you don't do that, so when you run a drill, for example, you might ask me later what are my favorite drills, but if you run a drill like shell drill, well, if there's failure, there's got to be consequences. So that group drops down, does 10 push-ups. The next four guys come in. So if you got a 12-man drill, you know, 4-on-4, your expectations are perfect. So if you can't run a drill perfectly, and then we all know what game slippage is, you know, when kids don't do things right in the game, you know, you take care of that a little bit. So it's a matter of expecting that. And accountability is, if you can't, I told kids, if you can't get over a screen, then you belong on the freshman team. You know, usually freshmen can't get over a screen. So, you know, and so if you don't start, you know, you can't be one of the worst players on defense and start. I had a kid at McMinnville, a 6'9", 270-pound kid that was one of the greatest kids ever, but lazier than heck. And he used to call me and say, am I the laziest guy you ever coached? And I said, yeah, you are. But he wouldn't practice hard, so he never started. Never started. But you know what he loved best? We went to the state tournament, and he said, this is the greatest thing in the world, Coach, because we don't have practice. You know, so he absolutely loved it. So, you know, practices were, if people ask me, what do you miss the most? I say practice. Practice is what I miss the most because you're teaching and you're demanding and you're not allowing some slippage, you know. And, you know, you're not screaming at kids all the time, but they know what's expected of them and they know there's consequences. So, you know, I tell you, the basis on defense was just to run the same drills and run them hard. And, you know, you can't spend all day on defense or you'll never score, you know. So, you know, maybe you got, you know, 30% of your practice might be defensive drills. But, I'll tell you what, they're going to be intense.
Yeah, what would that look like at a day at practice? I mean, were you more of a holistic guy, so you had five-on-five and you're teaching defense to everybody within the drill, or did you kind of scaffold your drills to help teach different parts of your defense?
No, I was always a breakdown. I'm a breakdown guy, always.
Okay.
You know, I love Ralph Miller, and I'll talk about him later, but Ralph never broke anything down, and he was a fantastic coach, okay? So
right.
he didn't break anything down. He just, you know, I learned a lot from him, but I still couldn't buy in to the fact that you don't break it down. For example, if I'm going to teach about defense, okay, we're going to go one-on-one full court to start with, all right? You control your man. Okay, now I don't put the big post guy with a little quick guard all the time, but you control your man. You control your man. You control your man for just, you know, you only got half of the court to control, let's say. And then, you know, then you move from there to three-on-three full court, and then you move to a rebounding drill, and then you go four-on-four shell drill, and your expectations in that are perfect defense. You get over a screen. You're talking all the time. You know, so, and we played no boundaries in four-on-four shell. There was no boundaries. So it went clear to the wall on each side, and it went clear out in the hallway. If the ball went in the hallway, you're out there after a loose ball. So, you know, so those drills, the kids loved it. I said, if you don't cheer for the four-on-four shell drill, we'll go all night on it. So they always cheered. They, you know, you made them think it was the world's greatest drill, you know.
Right.
And it was a fun drill because you're demanding excellence, and everybody on the court is going to be mad if a guy doesn't block somebody off because you're going to pay, you know. So, you know, that's how we did it. And, of course, you know, I'm right there. I didn't turn that drill over to an assistant or anything. That was my drill, you know. Mm-hmm. That was my drill. I'm the guy running that drill. And I pretty much loved practice, you know. I like to coach it. I like to coach every drill. So I hope that covered that for you.
Yeah, no, that's great. I like what you said about, you know, turning that over, you know, maybe the importance of the head coach running that drill. Like, what were some of the drills that you were like, nope, this is the drill I'm coaching, and what were maybe some of the other drills that you let assistants run?
Well, to give an example, like four-on-four shell was always my drill, but we split up. You know, we always split up and went, you know, wings were over here, posts were here, and point guards were here. Well, I always took point guards. I felt it was the most important position on the floor. How to get the ball in the outlet at full speed, how to change direction and cover, go across the floor, and don't bring the ball straight down the floor. You know, so I took charge of that. Sure, I love coaching the post, and I love coaching the wings, but I, you know, I just felt that was where I needed to be. You know, so that, you know, but I would say this. I would talk about Dana Altman a little bit later, but watching Altman coach a practice, he coaches the whole practice himself.
Okay.
Now, my assistants were very active. His coaches are great, but they're very active in the pre-practice. But once practice starts, he pretty well coaches it all. So I would throw myself into that category. I was involved in every drill, you know. Shooting drills, boy, I'm all over people for game speed, you know. Our expectations was when you walked on the floor, you know, I was not a stretching guy. I thought stretching was something you did. You know, I never grew up with stretching. And so our kids knew to stretch before. They knew the value and making sure they didn't pull a muscle or whatever. But, you know, when you walked on the floor, there was nobody standing around shooting the ball with each other. You went right to a hoop and shot consecutive sevens from 6 feet. You had to make six in a row and right around. And, you know, so, and you had spots you had to shoot from. So I'm not saying we never had any fun, But believe me, when you walk on the floor, it should be all business. You got to be ready to go. And sure, we walked around, talked to kids, and had some personal comments about school or whatever. But still, it was, hey, you didn't see somebody shooting a half-court shot in our practice unless we were shooting them on Saturday. You didn't. Mm-hmm. Those were things we didn't do. So it was always, we had the expectations, and they all knew what was expected of them. So, and so again, you fall back on, if the kid comes on the floor and the seniors are throwing basketballs at each other, well, you don't have much going on here. Not much example, right? So right there,
Yeah. I'm going to flip sides on the ball on you here. Think about offensively. When I've talked to different people about your teams, they almost always comment on your execution. And so the question I have, I think one of the hardest things to do as a high school coach is get high school kids to execute at a high level. So what did you do to get your kids to execute at a high level?
Well, I guess the word repetition would be, I was not a motion guy. You go out and watch basketball today and do obviously a lot of people run motion. And so motion to me was an equal opportunity act on offense. And I ran five-man passing game at times when I didn't have anybody in the post. But it was all about repetition. And so you probably didn't. I'm not sure you ever saw my teams play, but we ran a lot of specials, okay? Mm-hmm. So we might run a special every time down the floor, and we would execute it because we spent time on it. We spent time on it. And so the value was, I would tell you this, not only did we spend time there, we always had a walkthrough before the game. So the minute school was over, our kids were in the back gym shooting free throws, and then we went briefly over our defense, and then – we always ran our out-of-bounds plays right then. And on Saturday, we ran our out-of-bounds plays. So we could execute. I might have 20 out-of-bounds plays, but they could execute them because we practiced them. You can't, you have to take the time to, you've got to spend time on executing a play. So if you're going to run a 1-4 back door, which we ran out of the 1-4 a lot, every little thing is important. How do you make that pass? Do you take a step back? So I used to ask Ralph Miller, well, what if the guy can't pass it? He says, well, then he's on the bench. That was Ralph. Okay. So, and my thing was, no, I got to teach him. I got to teach exactly how to drop that leg and make a perfect bounce pass back there. And so little things, to me, little things were the most important things ever in coaching. In post play, how do you pin your man? You work on footwork every day. You get your butt into that guy and you move him. And so it's just little things like that. And how do you make the pass from high to low? Our expectation for our wings, out of the 1-4, our wings shot a lot of shots at the elbow. And so we had a rule that you had to make 7 in a row before you went in to shower. And, sometimes that was tough with the girls coming on. And if they weren't, if you were the last practice, well, they just stayed. So, execution. So our wings knew where they're going to get their shots. I had a chart called spot shooting where every kid knew where his spots were. I handed it to him and said, this is where most of your shots are going to come from. So don't let me see you shooting running hook shots. You're not going to shoot any, So that was really what it was all about on offense. I got to tell you that I think I was a role coach. I think if I had one strength, our kids knew their role. Okay, you didn't get out. Your role was pretty well defined for you. And if you're a great defender and rebounder, that's what you did. And if you weren't a 3-point shooter, you didn't shoot any of them. So you knew your role because every day in practice, we talked about everybody's role. We were very honest. If you couldn't make a certain amount of threes in 2 minutes, you didn't shoot them. So that was basically the way we ran our offense, and repetition, So.
Yeah, within that repetition, did you do a lot of, 5-on-0, or was everything against defense?
I would tell you we did some 5-on-0. You have to. Okay. We did some 5-on-0, and every time we could come on the floor, we would go 5-on-0, and then boom. Then you go against the defense. And, you know, that's where your assistants come in very handily. When they have the other team and you're trying to execute tough plays, and they may know what's coming, but you still got to crunch it. You know, you still got to make a great screen. You still got to make a great cut or a great pass, you know, so.
Yeah. Coach, I'm going to circle back around. You know, you talked about a little bit earlier how you got the opportunity to coach some really talented basketball players. You've also gotten to coach some really talented kids in the state of Oregon. You named one earlier. You had some really talented kids at Beaverton. I'm kind of curious, how did you go about coaching those kids as opposed to maybe your average high school basketball player that you had on your teams? And what was that like? How is that different? How is it the same?
Well, I guess I go back to McMinnville when, you know, Charlie was an eighth grader or so. I would pick him up at his house in the morning and bring him in, and we would shoot turnaround jump shots, jump hooks, and so on in the morning. Then he'd go off to junior high, okay? And so, you know, you have to, you know, a special player, you got to do special things for him. You got to make sure you allow him to be special. And so you got to spend more time, you know, making sure that he develops also. Not, you just don't want a great athlete out there. And I was lucky. You can't, as I said before, you can't have a double standard. You can't. One of the things I did, I have to tell you, is in summer ball, if I had a returning starter that showed up late or did something half speed in the summer, I might throw him right out of the gym, okay, tell him go home. Because, you know, you could never allow a kid that was, say, an All-State as a junior to think that he's going to do things a little differently. And so I always talk about that. I got on kids pretty hard in the summer to, you know, you don't coach intensely in the summer like you do, but at least I wanted the same little standards that we had of be 15 minutes early, you know, and so on. But, you know, with guys like Charlie and Chris Winkler, my son Rick, Jordy Leiden, Chris Rappel, Ron Grady, Anthony Taylor, you go on and on about great players. You know, when I inherited Anthony Taylor my first year, Anthony came to practice with a polo shirt on one of the first practices, you know. And I'm going, what? I said, get out of here, you know. And he was in shock because they had worn, before I got there, they had worn, their underwear, you know, about your shorts and to practice, you know. So, you know, that was just one of the little things. You know, and a funny little thing I used to do is I always made my team wear knee pads in practice. And my theory was I didn't want them kneeing our own guys. And in the games, they didn't have to wear them, which they didn't. You know, one or two guys might wear them. But, you know, it was just a little thing. And you didn't come on the court without your little those things. So same thing for the big-time guys. But, you know, then, you know, with a big-time player, you got to pay attention to recruiting and help them through that. Like a guy like Charlie had every school in the world on him. And of course, we took it right down to six schools and couldn't call him, but once every 2 weeks or something like that. And, you know, you do things like that. And then, of course, with good players, you got to, you know, help them get to the next level. So you spend time with them on extra little skill work because you really owe it to them, because it's always fun to have a player playing college basketball, whether it be Division III or Division I. You know, that's what it's all about, is these guys moving on. And, you know, the biggest thing that we always had was our 12th man was as important as our number one guy. And we made it that way. Our 12th man might be our practice captain for a week, and 11th guy the next week, 10th guy. So there was always a feeling of importance. You had to make sure that you didn't come over to your All-American or your All-State guy and pat him on the back every day. Very seldom would you talk about those guys unless they made a great effort. You know, after a game, you're talking about a guy that got 5 rebounds. And then you might say, hey, Ron, Grady, that was great. That 36 points was well-earned or whatever. But you didn't pat him on the back unless it was the defensive end or rebounding. Because, you know, great players' offense is usually pretty easy, you know. So, so that's kind of how I went through that.
Yeah. Before we take a break, you said you had a practice captain every week. Can you talk about that?
Well, he was part of, you know, he was part of the enthusiasm. So he would sit down with me, and we'd say, okay, you know, we got to get up for Jesuit in this situation. So you're going to talk about their players a little bit. And when you came to, you know, scouting reports might be the most boring thing in the world for players, okay? And mm-hmm. I never handed him a piece of paper that said, hey, Derek Dooman goes right every time or whatever. I never did that, okay? But I told him, if you guys don't listen and pay attention in my scouting report, we go through things, then I'm going to make you watch film, which they hated to watch film. So, you know, so your practice cap can jump right in on that part. He's verbal. He's helping you. He's telling them, look, this is this guy's best spot. This is his best move. You know, so you get another voice, and it's one of their teammates, one of your teammates. So that's one of the duties, you know. So, and then you always had, you know, you always have time when you talk to teams, and you might have the kid say something that week about, hey, you know, this is a pretty special game, you know. So-and-so's brother's going to be here. Let's play hard, make sure he's proud of us, and, you know, whatever. So that's the kind of thing we did.
Very cool. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll return with more from Coach Robertson right after this on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
The start of school means it's time to sign up or renew your Oregon Basketball Coaches Association membership. OBCA membership includes access to exclusive resources that help personalize instruction, understand players' mindsets, and maximize the impact of your practices. Members also receive access to the OBCA mentoring program and have a voice in improving the game at the state level. Membership starts at just $15 a year. Register online today at or.nhsbca.org.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Derek Dooman here with Coach Nick Robertson. Coach, going to shift gears a little bit from our first segment. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Les Schwab Invitational, which is one of the premier events in the state of Oregon for preseason basketball tournaments, and you are one of the co-founders of that tournament. Can you tell us a little bit about how that got started and how it's become the premier event that it is today?
Well, here's how it got started. Pretty interesting. We wanted to have a tournament. So Barry and I went on a quest, and we went to the OSAA. At that point, we were playing 22 games. Well, you couldn't have a tournament if you were stuck at 22 games. So we needed to be able to expand the season. And we went to them. We got voted down the first year and second year. And I think about the third year, they said, okay, you can play 2-for-1, you know, or whatever. You know, it was a complicated deal. So finally they let us get started, and you know, okay, so it only counted as, I don't know why they did that, but so you played 4 games, only counted as 2. Well, finally they came out and said, okay, you can play, you know, 26 or whatever it was. So that was the first hurdle, was to get that. And then also we had to talk to them about playing 2 in 1 day, because that came up. And, you know, we play 2 in 1 day all the time in the summer, as you know. And it's not a big deal. But, you know, to high school superintendents or school district soups, they didn't know that. They haven't played basketball in 30 years or something. And so you had to sell that to them also, because in that situation we needed to be able to do that. So from that point, once we got there, okay, we found Neil Lomax came to us. And what a great guy. He came to us and said, hey, look, I've got a sponsor. What do you guys have? We said, we got an idea for great tournament. So that's how it got started. Neil had Les Schwab, okay? And matter of fact, he had Les Schwab, and the OSA didn't at that time. So that caused a little hard feelings until Les Schwab, of course, then got right in behind the OSA also. So it would smooth that out, because they were mad at first. So we had a sponsor, and we took off. So the first year, it was played at Beaverton, South Salem, and then the final was at University of Portland. And matter of fact, my team won the first go-around. And we did play 2 games in 1 day. I remember I had a kid named Grant Puget, a great kid. And his calves cramped up during the game. We had to almost carry him off the floor. I still talk to him about that all the time when I see him. But, you know, that was a great start. And then John McCallum and Garrett Wood, they bought out Neil at some point. And, of course, Nike has been huge in this. Tony Dorado at Nike. He gets the three or four outside teams, the Nike schools, to come in. Mm-hmm. And then Barry and myself, we sit down with John McCallum and Reggie Walker, and we go through and pick out the, you know, we do it all, well, a whole year in advance. So by February of, let's say, if we were going to have Les Schwab in 21, we will have our teams, the 12 or 13 teams from Oregon will be picked at that point, okay? Mm-hmm. And then Tony Dorado comes in with the Nike schools, and that makes your tournament. And, of course, as everybody knows, you know, as a young guy growing up in coaching, we had the Far West Classic at Memorial Coliseum, and that was great. Well, that went away because, as you all know, that went away because those schools did not want to play somebody that might beat them and hurt their record to go to the NCAA, so that went away. And so we grabbed that spot as far as fan interest in the state of Portland. So we had great fan interest, and, you know, this is going to be kind of sad not to have it, I'm sure, this year. But it's just one of those things. So that's how it got started, and we're very proud of it. You know, I think it's 23, 24 years we've been doing it, some of the great players. And the best thing ever is, I had a team in it all the time, and we were good enough to be there. But, boy, I can remember having we played Montrose Christian, and they had who's the great player that moved to the New York Jets, or New York, not Jets, but the New York team. He played for Golden State.
Durant.
Yeah, Durant. So Durant's on this team with, and he's on the Montrose Christian, and he's got one of the best guard out of Brazil, the best guard out of Japan, the best guard out of Europe, and mm-hmm. I've got a good team, okay? And we go out there and get nipped by 30, and I'm thinking to myself, well, no one's gonna remember this, you know? So, you know, you go in the locker room afterward and say, hey, guys, just remember, keep an eye on that Durant guy. He might be pretty good someday, you know? So so that's a great, you know, great experience in that, yeah.
And it's recently expanded. There's now kind of the eight. Have you been part of that process and getting to expand that? And
everybody wants to be in a tournament, and so I'm not sure that's going to hold true. The main reason is it's for business wise. I'm not in on the business side of it. John McCallum owns the company that runs it, but I think it's a tough dollar on the eight because there's no real sponsorship behind it as far as finances. I mean, there's gear. You know, Nike is great about giving T-shirts and gear to kids. But so that might not stay. But that was a great expansion because then you've got eight other schools. And we brought in teams from out of the state, too. You know, we brought in Mount Spokane, who's one of my ex-assistants, and teams out of California. So that became a really fun tournament for kids, yeah. Yeah, that was great.
Very cool. Coach, can you talk about how you built a basketball program? You alluded to in the first segment about, you know, 3rd through 12th grade. You know, how did you get involved at the youth level to bring it up to being, you know, the Beaverton, McMinnville program as opposed to just the varsity team?
Well, I'm glad you asked me that because I think that was one of my strengths was, you know, when I said 3 through 12, I meant that. So, you know, when I first started, there was no basketball camps. My brother worked at the first camp, Conifer Camp, up in Snoqualmie Pass in Washington, and there was no Perry Sports Camp or Cascade or whatever. There was nothing like that. So, you know, I worked in the summer as a carpenter and ran summer basketball. But then pretty soon you ran your own camp, and at McMinnville, I started running a day camp and had it going on in two and three schools. When I went to Beaverton, I think my Beaverton day camp became the biggest in the state. I had three schools going at the same time. My seniors were always allowed to coach in it, and we started with the third grade. And when parents would call me and say, well, my son, will he be okay? I said, well, does he cry? And he said, no. I said, he's fine. He'll be good. Yeah. So, you know, but here was my thought. So from the third grade on up, I go to every camp. I talk every day at each camp. You know, my coaches are told they're never to sit down. Of course, they always sat down when I left. But, you know, so I'm on them to do the same thing. We have no excuses in the camp. There's no excuse. You know, and we run simple things, fundamentals, a lot of fun stuff. And all the young kids could call me Nick all the time. I said, well, when you get to high school, you got to call me Coach, okay? But you can call me Nick until then. And so, you know, it was great. And I used to tell him, I'd say, you know, when you walk down the street, if you see me coming and I'm walking along the street, you have two choices. You can either fake shot and drive and go by me or take a charge and I walk over the top of you. So those are two of the things that, you know, I mean, I spent most of my coaching life with one simple offensive move was show the ball and go to the rim. You know, and so if you can get by your guy, you now create shots for other players. Because, you know, how often do we ever have everybody have an all-state player that you go to and he jumps over people and scores? Well, we don't have that. So you've got to be able to teach kids to get past somebody and create opportunities for other kids. So we spent a lot of time on just like a little thing like fake shot and drive. Like I would tell him, you know, what does the average referee look at? He may not have played since the third grade or fourth grade. He's looking at your feet, so don't end up on the bench, you know. Don't be a travel expert. So we start out with just simple things, a lot of shooting drills. You know, the biggest thing, you know, in young kids is success. So, you know, you want them to have success. I mean, if a kid hadn't scored in 2 days in one of my youth camps, you know, somehow we cleared out a side and let him score. You know, it's all about success for young kids. And I would say this. In Beaverton, for example, I think my day camp was absolutely jammed with kids that weren't going to play for me. They're football, baseball guys, and they would love to come and talk to me all the time about, hey, coach, watch my fake shot and drive. You know, when they were seniors in high school, they had never played for me. But the families, it was part of their summer experience was to go to my camp. So you made it a real positive thing. And my rule was never let a kid go home unhappy. So I said, if he goes home unhappy, I probably get a phone call. Okay. Right. So if I get a phone call, then I'm coming in and talk to you, whoever the coach was. So, you know, it's a matter of success because, you know, kids, you know, boy, if they have success, it means everything. And so that's really how we built that. And as I said before, it was our seniors did not attend camp. They coached. And then I brought in, you know, you had to have an adult at every camp. And a lot of my assistants worked in the camps right with the kids. So it was just a great, and it was a very competitive thing. By the time they got to high school, our camp was really competitive. And so everybody took pride in it. So that's it. You know, like I say, the football guy would come talk to me his senior year about his best move, you know. So that made it a lot of fun for me, I'll tell you.
Yeah. That's great. What were some of the things that you did? You know, I'm sure at Beaverton, McMinnville, wherever, you shared athletes, right? So athletes are playing multiple sports, football, basketball, baseball, golf, tennis, whatever. What were some things that you did to make being a basketball player special? What differentiated being a basketball player from some of your other programs?
Well, you know, you wouldn't obviously downgrade another program, but you would talk about, you've got to talk about tradition. And hopefully your tradition is a winning tradition that has a lot of little things that are important. Like, okay, how do you dress for games? I was never a suit and tie guy, but we would talk about, okay, this is what we're going to do for game day. Okay, we will wear a tie. We will all wear a nice white shirt. We will wear sweats. You know, we will have meals at these homes on this night during the week. You know, we little things. Our Saturday practice always had some fun in it. We might have a barbecue afterwards, hot dogs. We always shot half-court game winners on Saturdays. We tried to have fun. You know, our practices were intense, but when they came off the floor, they were very proud of their effort. You know, so, and you know, the demands we had were, you know, you're a basketball player when you walk the halls. That was very important. I mean, I always said to them, you're a basketball player. So when I get a teacher calls me up and says, you're screwing off in class, then I've got to talk to you. And you've embarrassed the team. And so, you know, so just a lot of pride. I think, you know, pride is the number one thing that you have. Pride still matters, I told him. You know, even in this day and age, pride matters. You've got to take pride in what you do. And, you know, you tried to make your sport the most special sport, because when you look at it, you got a gym. You know, I used to tell him, look, I said, not downgrading football, but you got in football, you got a helmet on, you got shoulder pads, you got all this stuff on. Nobody knows who you are. You look out there, and maybe you hold on a play. They don't know who you are. People in the stands can hardly see. But in basketball, you got a little T-shirt on, a little T-shirt. You got shorts on, and you turn the ball over. Everybody in the world knows who you are. So you got to put some time in. This is a special sport. I mean, there's accountability in this sport, you know, because everybody can see what you do right and what you do wrong. So be prepared. And so, you know, that was a big thing for me. And just the way you do your locker room, you know, and your expectations. Of course, this was in I coached in the day and age when kids showered. And every kid had to shower. And why did I make that rule? So they would stick around after practice and talk to each other a little bit, you know. And you know, we had kids that were overly shy, and we had freshmen wearing their underwear in the shower, but okay, that's fine. But, you know, the thing was to get them to stick around and make it special. And everybody had to wear a stocking cap when they left. You know, just all the little things that you did make your program special. If you don't have anything you demand, it's not very special. So I just say that's the difference. And you know, the other thing that we did to make our whole program special is, I mean, I'm always at youth games. My players go to youth games on Saturdays. When we're done with practice, I say, hey, our seventh grade's playing at 3 o'clock. Be there. Do you guys be there? You guys be over here. So you've got to make it, you know. It's like going out and visiting a retirement home or something, you know. But you're going out and you're doing something that is a basketball player. You're in a basketball program, so it's special. Carry yourself like that.
Good stuff. Coach, you know, being in the profession for 40-plus years, you've obviously had a huge impact on coaches and players alike over the course of your career. Can you talk about maybe some of the people that you looked up to and that influenced you to provide who you are and where you went as a coach?
Yeah, well, I would say as a young guy, I student taught at North Eugene High School under Mel Krause, okay? And so Mel was a great basketball player at Oregon and became the baseball coach at Oregon, head coach. And he was at North Eugene, and we won the state title that year when I was there. And he was a great influence. All the kids called him Mel. Now, here I am. I'm a 20-year-old guy doing my student teaching and student coaching. And I didn't let kids call me Mel, but he did. But he could get away. He was very demanding. And he was just a super guy. And, you know, then Len Casanova, the football coach at Oregon. You got to remember, I grew up one block from Matt Court, like I told you. So I went to a lot of football practices. I would be right in his huddle. He'd go, Nick, get out of the way. You're going to get hit, you know. But he was a great man. You know, he went to the same church I did. And just a great man, a great coach way back in the 50s, you know. And Don Kirsch was the baseball coach at Oregon. And he was an assistant basketball coach. In those days, assistants were guys from baseball and football when I went to Oregon. So he was an assistant coach for us in basketball at Oregon. Just an outstanding coach and good person, you know. So I learned a lot of class things from them. And guys like Phil McHugh, and he was an assistant coach for us at Oregon also. And my high school coach, Jim Souza, coached all three sports. And he's still alive. He's 95. And he lives about maybe a half mile from me here in Beaverton. And I see him quite often, not during the pandemic, but I used to see him, and he's still doing fine. Then, you know, guys that, you know, Barry and I, we started the Oregon All-Star, really, when you think about All-Star teams. We started that in 1979 or 80, right in there. And we went for 23 years of running that. And I learned a lot from Barry, you know. He's one of the kindest coaches I've ever met. He played almost everybody in every game, and he was really, really good at running his offense, and defensively they were solid. And then Ken Harris, a guy I coached against a lot over the years. Ken was at Churchill and then at Sunset. We probably played each other, I don't know, I don't know, 70 times over the years. And, you know, he was an AD also, so we also were both athletic directors and basketball coaches in Beaverton School District. And, you know, what I learned from one of the biggest things I learned from Ken was, by golly, we show up for an AD's meeting the next day, and Ken just lost in overtime by one, and he's the same guy. You know, I learned from him, hey, you can get over these things, you know. You know, kids get over things in a hurry. Coaches sometimes don't. You know, he's just a great person also to be around. Then Altman at Oregon is a good friend, and I go to his practice quite often. And, you know, I always text him after games. And one of the best coaches I've been around. I think Dick Harder at Oregon was influential in the way he got effort out of kids, you know. I mean, you know, no one ever coached me to take a charge in high school. And I remember playing when Harder, of course, they all took charges, and I'd never practiced when I took one in AAU ball when I was playing in McMinnville. And, my God, I think my chest hurt. I couldn't breathe for a week. So, you know, but, you know, you had to teach things. I learned, well, let's go up in the wrestling room and learn how to do this. And Ralph Miller, you know, I really loved Ralph. He had a place at Black Butte, and so did I. We talked quite often. And his daughter, Shannon, coached at Beaverton High for a while when I was there. But one of the best coaches. I mean, again, he didn't break things down, but boy, I'll tell you what, they did things so well. And he was full court pressure all the time. And he ran the 1-4 like I like. I love the spacing, and I love the high-low out of it. Very simple basketball, you know. And he was a very demanding guy. Kids did what he wanted them to do. Okay. So those are some of the guys, you know, I had. And then we'll talk later maybe about assistant coaches and so on. So,
yeah. When you watch high school games now, what bothers you the most? What do you think is maybe being undertaught, or what bothers you by watching high school hoops today?
Well, I guess, first of all, defensively, I see some of the worst efforts I've ever seen. Somebody might give up 20 lay-ins in a game. I'm going, holy smoly. You know, just incredible that they don't put value on defense. So you know they're not practicing defense. You know they're not. So that's number one. Number two is equal opportunity. Basically, I just never had an equal opportunity situation. You know, you proved yourself. If you're going to be a three-point shooter, you proved yourself. And so I go to games, and I watch a girls' game or a boys' game, and every kid is firing threes. And, my God, some kids, they don't even hit the rim. They go five in a game, and I'm going, well, I wonder, how did they do in practice doing that? And it's not hard. Kids can accept a role. They can accept a role. You know, it doesn't mean, just because their parents want them to shoot a three doesn't mean it's a good deal, you know. I used to tell the kids, this is your role. Make sure you go home and explain it to your parents so they don't yell at you to shoot from 19-9, you know. So I think those two things are what bother me the most is offenses are not set up to where, you know, your best player should, you know, your best player ought to get 15 shots a game, hopefully. And a guy that can't shoot a lick, you know, he's going to get three or four. But, you know, it just can't be the other way around if you expect to win. And then defensively, I just can't believe people giving up lay-in after lay-in, you know. So, you know, you just can't do that. So, all about, I guess you'd say, you know, it's all about pride, you know. So,
When you look back on your career, what are you most proud of?
Well, I guess you'd say, you know, first of all, longevity doesn't happen a lot these days. I look at Tom Johnson out of Barlow, and he's getting close to me, I think, in not a year. So I think he's over 36 or something. I had 41 as a head coach. And you know, longevity means that you have the respect of the community and parents aren't bugging you. The young coaches I feel bad for sometimes because parents feel like they should be able to go in and tell him what to do. You know, and basically I used to tell people, you know, that wanted to call me, I'd say, you know, what, are you a doctor? Yeah. Well, do you want me to come in your office and tell you how to do a surgery? Well, no, I'm not going to be there. So don't come in and try to tell me what to do. So, you know, so basically, you know, that's how you get longevity, is you don't pay attention to those kind of things. And probably the thing most proud of is ex-players and my assistant coaches. You know, I had Ross Peterson and Rick Hassman were my assistants at McMinnville. and I brought Ross to Beaverton as a baseball coach, and he won a state title there. And Rick Hasman came back and was my assistant again at Beaverton. And then you mentioned Pat Coons. I mean, Pat's like a son to me. He's young enough to be a son. I'm trying to help him with his golf game. But so he was with me 10 years, and then he had chances to take a lot of jobs, but he waited, and he took Westview, and he did a great job. And of course, now he's retired, living the life, you know. So, most proud of, you know, I look at my ex-players and like David Wagenblass, one of my ex-assistants, the head coach of Mount Spokane, Sean Alderman, you know, at Tigard, Stu Bailey with him, Mark Henry used to be a head coach. I've got a bunch of guys out there that were head coaches, okay? And I guess I'm proud of how hard we played, you know, how tough we played, and how much pride we took in how we played. So, I mean, even my last years, you know, we were, you know, the league was real. Our Metro League used to be so tough to get to the tournament when only two teams went. You know, not everybody went to the state in those days. You know, you played your fanny off to be able to, you know, beat somebody. And you know, you play in a league with a program like Jesuit that we dominated for the first 15 years, and then Dunleavy came around, and pretty soon they became a dominating force, and their coach became a really fine coach. We ruled. Sunset and Beaverton used to rule the Metro, and, you know, now, of course, it's still a tough league, but things have moved around a little bit. So, I have no regrets on my career. I had a great time, and again, I think pride matters, and that's what we, you know, pride in everything you do, studies, how you look, you know, what kind of effort do you put out as a person, and I guess the main thing is right now I've got a lot of ex-players that are great friends, you know, Eric Estep, Ron Grady, Anthony Taylor, Winkler, and Charlie from McMinnville, you know, Ron Grady, we play golf, and Jordy Lydon, guys like this I see quite often, and a guy named Ryan Metten, who's still in the game running all the tournaments, called Hoop Source, his company, you know, so, staying in touch with those players is, I think, it's the most crucial thing now. I've been 15 years without a team, so, you know, that's quite a while, you know.
All right, we're going to take another break. When we return, Coach Robertson will try to beat the shot clock here on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
Join us for the 13th annual Nike, OACA, and OBCA Basketball Coaching Clinic, December 4th and 5th at the Sheraton Airport Hotel. Strict COVID protocols and restrictions will be in place. Register today at www.OregonCoach.org.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. We're talking with Nick Robertson, former boys basketball coach at Beaverton High School, amongst others. Coach, for my next set of questions, I'm going to put you up against the shot clock. So here's how it works. I'm going to put a timer on for 35 seconds. And I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire questions that should only have 1 to 2 word responses, hopefully. And what we'll do is I'll follow up with any questions, or if there's something you want to talk about more in depth, we'll follow up with that after the timer ends. That sound good?
You betcha. Okay.
All righty. 35 seconds on the timer. We are starting now. Do you think Oregon High School basketball should have a shot clock?
Yes, they need it badly.
Do you think it should be implemented at sub-varsity levels?
I think you got to get it in first on the varsity level, okay?
If you're up 3 points with less than 10 seconds, do you foul?
No.
What's your favorite way to guard on-ball screens?
Sag.
Do you think the three-point line should be moved back?
No.
What's your favorite pregame meal?
Well, it was steak when I was a kid, okay?
How do you celebrate after a big win?
Take all the coaches out, go to a Chinese restaurant, have a Qingdao beer. There you go.
What's one word officials would use to describe you?
Mean.
That's time, Coach. Nice work. Good work, Coach. That was a good, good possession there. Good possession.
I had to listen. Caught me there a little bit. Yeah.
There you go. Coach, obviously, so the first question, you know, it's the shot clock segment. Shot clock is a hot topic issue, both in the state of Oregon and around the country. You know, you had mentioned you're in favor of the shot clock in the state. Can you elaborate on that answer and why you're in favor of it?
Well, it would just make it a better game. There's no question in my mind. We ran the shot clock in Les Schwab 1 year, and then the OSA clamped down again. They said, "What did you do?" And it was great. You know, it never comes up in those kind of games. Never really comes up. But, you know, now and then you've got a team that might grind in their passing game for 50 seconds or so, and it's just boring as heck. And the shot clock just makes it a better game. I would have loved to coach with the shot clock because I was a guy that I pulled the ball out. If I had a two-point lead with 2 minutes to go, I pulled the ball out. And then we would attack. If you came out, we would attack. If you didn't come out, we'd just stay there. So it ruins the game. You know, if I had a 35-second clock, I would have had to go to the hoop at some point. And so, you know, I just think it really needs it. We were very close. I think Pat Coons did a great job on it, and I think we were very close at one time. I think the pandemic kind of hurt us here a little bit, but we had a major company that might have come in and really sponsored it in the state of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of interesting with the pandemic how things have been put on hold, but I do know that there has been a big push, and it seems like we're moving in the right direction, no matter how slow.
I agree. We'll get there maybe someday, yeah.
Yeah. You know, we talk about officials briefly. What was kind of your philosophy with officials? I think that's always kind of a fine line to tread for coaches. You know, did you have a, you know, maybe – not until now you've thought about your philosophy of how you handled officials.
No,
did you have a plan? Or?
Yeah, I did. Okay. You know what? I knew them all very well. You know, when you coach that long, you know, some guys are a little intimidated. Some guys are great, and some guys are almost like friends, you know. And mm-hmm. So you've had them for so many years. So basically I did this. I only got on referees if they made a call that didn't have anything to do with the game. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if there's a holding call 25 feet from the ball, I'd say, what in the world did that have to do with the game? And that's really what I would get on them about. You know, they make mistakes, and they admit it. I had a guy tell me he choked, and he cost us a state title. He told me I choked. Okay? So, well, they do. All right? But you know what I used to do before games? I would go out and talk to refs, and I'd say, hey, remember one thing? They say, yeah, we know. I'd say, we do not travel, okay? We work on fake shot and drive every day. None of my guys travel. Just remember that. So if they call a travel on our guys during the game, I was all over them. So I always did that, and it was kind of a funny thing to do. I'd just say, hey, remember one thing? They go, yeah, you know. So I did that. But then I didn't ride them the whole game. But, you know, I talked to them all the time. I talked to him. I'd say, man, you owe me one there or whatever, you know, it was nothing bad. And, you know, my expectations were that they worked hard and they didn't miss, you know, a crucial play, and they didn't make a call that decided the game that was a nitpicky call, you know? So, I mean, they make bad calls. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, we all make mistakes. So, you have to get over it. And I never went in the locker room after a game and blamed an official for the game. Mm-hmm. Never. Okay, so I always said to kids, hey, look, you know, we could have done better. Remember the two or three plays in the fourth quarter that we threw the ball away? Okay, so I didn't want to – never – that's like having an excuse. So to me, I did not want to have an excuse, okay?
Absolutely. Coach, I'm told you're a bit of a superstitious guy with, you know, the ties you wore or maybe what you ate before or after a game. What were some of your superstitions you had when you were coaching?
Well, I had a brother that was a very good coach. He died young of a bee sting. And so I had his tie that he had worn to big ball games. And I wore that in some big ball games. Okay, so that was one of my deals. driving to a game, I always drove the same way. Okay, I always took the same route. Okay, national anthem, I always stood at the back of all my players. Okay, I always wore a tie and white shirt or whatever, and dress shirt and sport coat. Those are just little things. I sat before games. My players were required to be there for the JV game. And by the start, and I sat behind them always, and I could look at them that way in the back. I'd go to myself, geez, look at that guy's hair. He's really sloppy. Things I hadn't noticed before or something, you know. I'd have it in my mind. But, pregame meal was not much. I ate very little. And then after game, we always went to a Chinese restaurant that we had a lot of fun. And every Friday night, we would go there after a game, win or lose, you know. So, you wouldn't allow yourself to sit around and sulk about a loss or something like that. So, I go to Mass every Sunday, and I never sat there and prayed for a win. I just prayed that we would play hard and nobody get hurt. So those are about it.
Coach, you mentioned, you had a ton of in-line, out-of-bounds plays that you guys would run. And in my research, I found that was similar. Do you have a favorite one maybe that you could talk us through, a go-to maybe that you would run in a close game?
Well, I would have to tell you that, basically pick the picker. You never invent something yourself, right? And
right.
One of my college teammates named Butch Kempton, who coached at Lynn Benton, grew up at Klamath Falls. We were college teammates at Oregon. And he coached at Madison back in their heyday. And he ran pick the picker. And so when I went to coach the McDonald's All-American game and back in the East Coast, it was actually in Virginia, I think, Charlie Sitton scored on it 4 times during the game. They had never seen it, okay? You can imagine. So this is pick the picker, okay?
Yeah.
Well, this is 1980, okay? And no one had seen it. I must have got 20 letters on pick the picker, So, if you can get somebody to switch on an out-of-bounds play, you usually have them, right? So, that was basically what you did there. I had so many, and I would tell you this, Derek, that I had a lot of plays where we would lob the ball after an out-of-bounds play, okay? And we'd run a play. We'd run it. We'd get it in bounds, and they would think the play is over. Then we'd backpick somewhere and throw a lob, okay? And I loved that. I thought lob plays were so exciting because I had guys that could get up and dunk the ball. And they were so exciting because, fans love them. Kids love them. But you have to practice them because the guy throwing the lob pass, he has to be dang good, or it doesn't happen, So, I would say that my basic play I always ran was a 3. We call it a 3. And so you're in a box set with the guy on the ball would be a post, and he's widened out about 10 feet, and he screens up for, say, a guard. And the inbounder is a shooter, okay? And so the ball gets inbounded to the guard, breaks off of that guy's screen, and that post then goes over and sets a double. And so now the point guard makes a great cut, and you get him the ball about 17 feet or so, 15 to 17. He catches the ball. Now your inbounder is the shooter, and he now comes off the double, okay? And so everybody in the world knows that's where you're going, right? Mm-hmm. But what we called it was duck, and we ran this out of a half-court set too. So as I dribble the ball over as the point guard, my top guy in the double screens down on the other post as the guard went by, and then he rolls right in the middle. You hit him, and we used to call that that was a game winner for us. We ran that as an offense, and we ran it as an out-of-bounds play. So as the decoy runs off the double, which is your best shooter, you now screen down on the lower part of the double, and he comes off. He's got about a 4-foot little shot. Okay, so I use that a lot as a game winner. Okay,
I like it.
And I think you've got to have game winning plays. Kids have got to know, man, this is our game winner.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you have a favorite drill? I alluded to it a little bit in the first segment, but do you have one that you like to do every day that you just really were passionate about that you thought really helped your team?
You bet. Well, I think shell drill was my favorite drill. I know it was tough on our players, and I know they had to fake enthusiasm to love it. And but the demands of it, and it was, I mean, I gave them a goal. You know, you get three in a row, perfect, you're out, we're done, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it wasn't like it was going to go 20 minutes, which I thought was ridiculous. You know, I remember had an assistant once that ran a three-man, split the post drill for half an hour. I thought, oh, my God. You know, so drills to me, you never set one up that would go too long. You didn't set a goal and say, hey, you got to do 20 of these in a row, you know. So shell drill had to be done perfect. Once it was perfect, both teams got it perfect, we're out of it. We understand that we're now ready. Then offensively, I would tell you this. In this day and age where you shoot threes, I tell this to anybody in a clinic too, we had two-minute shooting drill, okay? And I put it in at a lot of schools. And you have 2 minutes to shoot threes. There's three guys shooting at a hoop and three shaggers. So you got your two main hoops covered because most side hoops a lot of times don't have the three-point line. So you're only as good as your shagger, but you have 2 minutes to make threes. And, you know, the best I've seen was Peyton Pritchard made 34 in a row at Westland. Okay, I've had players make 30, but a really good shooter makes around 24, 26. Okay, so he has a green light in a game. Okay,
right.
So if you make, you think 20, you know, you're questionable on the green light. Okay, so but if you make 18 or something like that, you know the ball has to go inside out first. It has to touch the post and come back to you. You can't just come down the floor and shoot it. And very seldom do we ever have a guy come down and just shoot the ball. But I would say this. My point guard's job in the fast break was to get down the floor and get the ball to a three-point shooter. And if he had the green light from practice, he shot it. Okay, so if you made 12 or 10, I used to tell the kid, if you shoot a ball in the game from out there, you should run out in the street and throw up. Okay, so basically, those kids, there was no dreamland. I had a kid named Kevin Riley who was a quarterback at Cal for 3 years, started. Mm-hmm. Great kid. What a great kid. Great personality, rebounded for me, played the high post for me, and begged me to shoot a three in a game. But he could never make 20, okay? So after practice, every day he'd say, if I make three in a row, can I shoot one? I'd say, yes. And he never made three in a row. Before every game, he'd ask me, can I shoot a three? I said, well, no, you can't. You know? So, I mean, to me, now the whole team understands, when you get a whole team in and you say, hey, Derek, how many did you make? And you go 26, then they know you're shooting in a game. And if I say to Nick, how many did you make? And you go 10, they all look at you and go, you're not shooting it in a game. So everybody understands that role. And when Derek, who made 26 in practice, shoots in a game, everybody stands up like it's going in, right? Mm-hmm. And if Nick shoots it, everybody hides their head, sort of, you know? So it's kind of a fun thing. You know, you talk about it and you go, hey, you know, Nick, maybe another week you might make 20, you know? So in that drill, it's an embarrassing drill. So here's how I coached it. If you were my best shooter, I stood behind you and I rattled you the whole time, told you were horrible, yada, yada, yada. If you were my worst shooter, I'd stand behind you and coach you up, like, shoot middle hoop, shoot for the middle hoop, great follow through, come on, come on, come on. But if you're my best shooter, I would cause more pressure because, to me, coaching was all about creating pressure in practice. That was my role. You had to create game pressure in practice. So you don't shoot threes and have guys laughing and lollygagging around and music blast. I mean, I'm not a music guy. I never grew up around music. So, you know, I didn't have music in my practice. I go to practices where they do it. I'm sure it's nice. But so you know, that drill had a lot of accountability in it. It set roles a little bit. It's only 2 minutes. We went 4 minutes because everybody gets to shoot. That's 4 minutes of your practice. And I thought it was pretty dang important because the kids then understood what's going on. Hope I didn't go too long on that.
No, that's perfect. That's perfect. I like it. Well, Coach, that's all I got for you today. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, Derek, hey, good luck with your season. I hope you guys are playing January, February. Okay? All right.
Yeah, thank you. If you have any follow-up questions or want to get a hold of Coach Robertson, you can find his contact information in the episode description. Or you can come listen to him speak at the 13th annual Nike OACA OBCA
basketball clinic December 4th and 5th at the Sheraton Airport Hotel. You can stay up to date with the OBCA by visiting our website, or.nhsbca.org, or following us on Facebook or Twitter. We hope you have a wonderful holiday season and wish all you coaches the best of luck this coming basketball year. We'll return with season 2 of the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast a few weeks after the completion of our season. Until then, coach them up.
Thank you for listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Is there a coach you'd like to hear from or a topic you'd like to hear us discuss? You can write us a message on the Anchor website or send us an email at OregonBasketballCoaches@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Spotify.